You are listening to episode 147 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Big Brother is watching you get fired.
Welcome to episode 147 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is July the 20th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is James.
Hi. I was expecting an intro, something related to current events. What's going on?
Nothing. Nothing's going on. It's one of those, I was like looking through the movies, and no movies came out, no big sporting events. Levi Stadium opened up, but, I mean, you know, not too much fanfare, and just a slow one, not much of anything. I gave myself a black eye last night, is about it, which was fun.
Looks like it's already healed.
Oh, it wasn't.
Okay,
it wasn't
all right. In the right shadow, I see it.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad of a shiner. I was encouraged to stage dive, and I decided to take the advice. At which point I promptly jumped and nobody caught me, and I hit the ground, but I was okay. I rallied, I got back up on stage, and at which point they were all like, everybody was disappointed that I didn't really stage dive, so they started to grab me to throw me, and I was like, this is a really bad idea, guys, we're not gonna do this twice. And when they finally like picked me up and had me in the air, and I realized I would not be able to fight against them, I was like, okay, let me actually do it. And so I got everybody in, like, close to the stage, and then did it again, and which worked a lot better. But that time, like, I nailed somebody's head with my face. And it was rough. It was rough, James. It was rough. It's the first time I'd ever stage dive, and it dove, and it was, tried to crowd surf, and it was not as successful as I might have liked it to be.
Wow.
But that was pretty much my weekend. That was like the highlight of it. That's not true. I actually had some really awesome stuff going this weekend. Went on a date Friday night, which was cool, but again, you know.
Are you going to go on another date?
I'm sure hoping.
Nice.
She said she'd be willing to, but
that's good. Knows.
Sometimes they're just, oh yeah, we can totally do this again. Never picks up the phone again.
Yeah. Did you watch that YouTube video that our sister sent about that TED talk about dating?
No.
Did she send it to you? Let's start with that.
Yes, I meant to watch it and got distracted.
So it's a TED talk. So a little more incentive for you.
Yeah.
And it's about dating essentially, and this idea of how your, you know, essentially your emotions cloud your judgment. And so you need to actually rely on your friends and family to help you determine if that person's right for you or not, because you will convince yourself that that's the person, and then logic will no longer talk to you. So it was Lisa's way of saying, hey, family, when I start dating people, like, let me know for real. This honest feedback is appreciated. But she didn't actually say that. She just sent the video, and apparently she had other friends who were like, what are you trying? Are you trying to send me a subtle hint here that I need to break up with my boyfriend? it's like, no, that wasn't it at all. But the point of it being, or one of her things in the talk was that you shouldn't be like, oh man, I hope this person really likes me. It should be more like, I'm going to decide if I really like this person, you know, and be more of a choosier. Don't just try to adapt to whoever it is and hope whoever it is likes you. Be more like, no, I'm a catch, and I'm going to decide if they're right for me. But
well, okay, I'll be honest, because I have not watched the video, but and I hope she doesn't listen to this podcast just out of curiosity, trying to find out more about me. But we actually had that conversation where we talked about, like, you know, being your own person within a relationship, and how, like, you know, and how the bane of my past relationship, my most disastrous one.
You talked about an old relationship. Was this the first date?
Yeah, it was.
And then you stage dived. Sounds like a winning
Yeah, it was a heck of a James. Honestly, I'll be totally honest. There were like five things that are like off limit topics. First time I talk to people, like I don't bring them up, and I talked about every single one of them. It was just like I got done with it. Like that was a disaster. It was an unmitigated disaster. She doesn't seem to hate me, so that's good. But
maybe she's got class.
I'm hoping I'm just a catch.
I should
because
laugh.
She seemed totally.
Totally.
We talked about that idea of like you know you want to be your own person, then you want to maintain your independence within the context of a relationship. That way you're still a compelling person. You're not just some hollow, you know, form of what you think they want, because that's usually unsatisfying. And
so you're not your Facebook wall. You're more complete.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, but yet the very thing you walk away from it the very next moment, as soon as she gets out of the car, is God, I hope she likes me.
Yeah.
What did I do? So.
Cool.
Yeah.
But that's not why we're here this week.
It's not? Oh, man, I like talking about that kind of stuff.
I know.
But that's not why we're here this week. Man, there's a lot of stuff to talk about this week. This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations dealing back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yes, I work for HP and HP's new board of directors. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Nice. Cool. If you want to follow us throughout the week, because our lives are exciting and adventurous. And
shouldn't laugh at that either. Yours is. Mine isn't.
Oh. That's not true.
I go around measuring rooms. That was the highlight of my week, so...
Yeah, compared to my stage dive, that's probably a...
Yeah, I found this new app called RoomScan that lets you do floor plans automatically using your iPhone without having to use a tape measure and graph paper. It's so awesome.
I did read your blog post about that.
Gotta admit, it was, like, semi-cool.
It was very cool. It's a cool piece of technology. And if you want to learn more about that sort of thing, you can follow us throughout the week at our social media sites.
Yeah, I am at James Furlow on Twitter and jamesfurlow.com on the web.
All right.
Just spicing things up a little bit since it was a boring week.
All right, fair enough. I am at Matthew D. Furlow on Twitter. My Instagram is NextWigan4. Yeah, that was weird. And now you can also go to furloughbros.com. That's where we got all our links to all the articles we talk about throughout the week and the videos and all the cool stuff. So go check that out, furloughbros.com. That's the place to be. But unlike the rest of the world, this was not a super boring week of tech. It was actually, there's interesting things going on.
Yeah, in a little bit we'll talk about... how much Apple hates IBM and how much Microsoft hates their employees. But first, we're going...
The answer is not much and a lot in that order.
Yeah. But first, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Have you always wanted to be a Jedi?
Yes, I have. Until I started hating Star Wars. And then I still think I want to be a Jedi, but...
So, this recently came on my radar via my wife. So, it probably is really old, but whatever. it's this article about the Myo. M-Y-O. Myo. It is an armband that... can track your I can't remember what they're called now. Here, I should probably go back a page here so I can remember it. It tracks your arm movements and your the muscles and the movements of your fingers and stuff. in your arm. It like has like a whatever the arm equivalent of a like an EEG is.
Okay.
So like for example, so this thing, it literally, think of it like you know those sweat armbands that that the cool athletes would wear, or like tennis players would wear, I guess.
Yes.
Which is sadly not cool, but they would still wear them anyways. So it kind of looks like that. Or if you had tennis elbow, it'd go in that exact same spot. And if you open and close your hand, it can recognize it. If you lift your arm up, it recognizes it, or move it to the side, it can recognize it. And so essentially what this thing becomes is a controller using your arm. And so they did all sorts of examples where, and we'll link to this article by Dipley. When you go to the article, there's like 4 pages. Click next page. Okay, keep going, because the first page doesn't give you a ton of information. I missed that the first time around until I started reading the comments and went, I feel like there's more to this article. and there are. Even though it says very clearly page 1 of 4 at the top, I missed it because, you know, I just care about the content. But anyways, they show this guy like playing a game where it's a, you know, first person shooter, and it's like he's holding a gun pretending to, and it can sense when you pull the trigger on it, and when you move back and forth. They showed it as using it for a music control system where you could, you know, flick your wrist and, you know, you could like swipe and it would go to the next song, or you could like put your hand up and it would stop it like you were a police officer, things like that. And then they said that they've designed it so that you can actually connect 2 up on each wrist, and so you can get full-on movement and whatever. And I was like, okay, that's pretty cool, I guess. And then they took it a step further, and I saw the future, essentially.
Okay.
I've got this video that is on page 3 of this. So it's hidden. But what they did was they wrote some software to go with the Oculus Rift, where they said essentially what it does is they created a set of arms that, according to the Oculus Rift, look like the arms are in the normal position for you. And then as you move your arms and do stuff, it responds to it. And
weird.
And yeah, I watched the video, and they were like, I don't know about you, but they were saying, because you've tried it, but there's moments of like, oh my gosh, this is like, you lose yourself in the world, right?
Yeah.
And then they say, but then you might move, and it, you know, doesn't feel as much like it necessarily. They said with this, where all of a sudden you can see your own arms in this world, they went, you now feel like you're totally in it for longer than just a few seconds. You're like, you're there. And they show videos of people playing with them, and they essentially made it so you could throw like magic fireballs, like Mario style, out of your hands, and so you could lift them and you could throw a fireball and it would then go and like catch trees on fire and stuff.
Dude, there is going to be a wicked awesome Last Airbender video game where it's going to be basically like, you know, it's going to be a fighting game, like Street Fighter or something, but you're all like earthbenders and firebenders and airbenders and waterbenders.
That sounds great.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, no, it's a totally airbender. Think magic, think Mario, think Star Wars was their example for it, where, you know, it's this idea of you can use the Force, and I can imagine you get a lightsaber component. Could you imagine if somehow you can combine the Oculus Rift with this on a Sony PlayStation where they've got the little magic wand things?
Yeah.
And you totally feel like you've got a lightsaber and are...
Well, the really cool part about what they're doing is all you really need to do is to give somebody, like, a paper towel roll. Because theoretically, you're tracking their arm, and they're holding it. You know, now you're just getting something to feel. You know, it feels like it. You could, because you technically could do it without it.
That's true. That's true. I didn't even think about that. So this thing is coming out in September. Pre-order right now for only $149.
That ain't bad.
That's very reasonable. Now it looks like you would want two, so probably $300. But yeah, pretty darn awesome. There's a on the fourth page, there's just a bunch of videos. I highly recommend just going and looking at their intro video and then the one where they're using the Oculus Rift with it, because you're just like, oh, that's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah.
I like
that. That seems really cool. I can't wait for, you know, I think the big step on a lot of this stuff is that you got to come out with a whole package. You got to come out with the Oculus Rift or some sort of a competitor. That you got to come out with the control system, whether that's the Sony, you know, Wand things or this or, you know, all the different things that are out there. You got to settle on one, sell it as a complete package, and there's got to be a game that is so compelling that you can't play without this, that everybody's going to want to get. I mean, you got to build a system selling game and then sell it as a package.
Yeah.
And until you get to that point, you know, these are all going to be interesting novelties or even, you know, really impressive pieces of hardware that just never make it anywhere. So it will be really interesting to see that. I think somebody's got to come up with a game that cannot be played without this.
Right.
And then, you know, and whoever does that is going to win, you know, the halo of this experience. But it seems really cool. Seems really cool. I'm optimistic for it.
I think it's like you said, I think you said it actually maybe last week or 2 weeks ago. There seem to be enough players in this space now where something's got to work.
Yeah.
It has that same like smartwatch feel. There's enough people doing it, someone's going to get it right eventually.
Yeah.
And then once they do and it's proven, it'll just be an avalanche. You know, think iPhone.
Right.
Which it may take more years than we want because everyone's headed in this one direction. It really requires someone else to kind of say, actually, this is what we want.
Yeah. But I got to believe that it's the killer app syndrome here is really what's required. You need a system seller. And I think and really and truly it'll be interesting. Like, I keep thinking Sony's in the best position for this. And if they can come up with a system selling app, you know, game to move their Project Morpheus VR stuff, you know, they're in the best, at least to be the early winner in this market, they're in the best position. But
I agree.
We will see. Because I think this other stuff is really cool, and it's got a lot of potential outside of just playing video games with the Oculus Rift, but people aren't buying them. What the heck? What's his name? My hero.
Elon Musk?
Elon Musk. They made a big, his car company, Tesla, made a big announcement this week. They are going to be selling a cheaper Tesla, and it has a name officially. This new, you know, it's long been announced that they've got the plan of, they started out with the Roadsters, which is like their high-end luxury or their high-end sports car. Then they came in with their quote mid-tier luxury car, which is like the Model S, Model X. And by mid-tier, they mean like a $100,000 car.
Yeah.
So now they're coming out with their cheap car, the one for the plebeians.
For the masses.
It's a $3,500 car, and originally it was going to be called the Model E. Turns out Ford was not super pleased with them using that name, as it is something that they evidently have copyrights on. It's funny. When they first said, like, you know, when I first read the controversy, I was like, really? What's the Model E? Like, what car are they, do they have that's a Model E thing? And it finally it occurred to me that, oh yeah, that's right. It's one of the first ones, right behind the Model T. But yeah, so Tesla had to change the name, and they've officially announced what it will be. And so they liked the general shape of the letter E, so they just flipped it around, and they're calling it the Model 3.
Boom.
Yeah. So it's their third generation car. And yeah, it's exciting.
So do we know anything about it yet?
It's going to be about $3,500. It'll go about 200 miles on a charge. I'm going to own one one day. Those are...
$35,000 is still a chunk of money for a vehicle.
That's a really nice car. I mean, you know, that's nothing to scoff at. That's more than I paid. Let's be real.
Let's see here. That is more than I have paid for all of my cars combined.
Yeah, me too. By a long shot.
Yeah.
For me.
It's all right. Okay, so we don't know anything about it. We just know the name.
Yeah, we also know that it's coming out sometime soon. It doesn't actually say in this. Okay, wait. Tesla says the Model 3 will come sometime after their SUV, the Model X, which ships sometime in 2015. Alas, there are still no concrete evidence as to what the Model 3 will look like, though it is said it looks like a smaller version of the somewhat wide-bodied Model S. So, their sleek and sexy Model S, they're just basically going to make it a little bit more different.
Mm.
And that'll be it. I'm pretty excited.
I can tell. You know nothing about it and you're like, I'm going to buy one.
Yeah.
Well, you just like Tesla cars in general.
Yeah, I like the company. I like what they're doing. I mean, it's so clearly the future of transportation.
Nah. It's an intermediate step.
To what?
To nuclear. Something different. To bicycling.
Natural gas. Well, I mean, the whole thing about it is, and the genius behind it, and one of the reasons why, from an infrastructure perspective, it makes complete sense, is it's sort of like what we've done with the, you know, what is gas? Gasoline is a power container. It has electrical potential built into its chemical bonds. It's got electrical potential in the form of a chemical, and then we release that electrical potential and convert it directly through heat and combustion into mechanical energy. Well, this one is like, you know, so we do that all within the combustion motor. Well, the brilliance of the electric car, and I think the reason why it's like I kind of view as kind of your ultimate in ground-based transportation, and what you'll see for a long, long, long time is that it's what it basically does is the whole idea is it liberates you from any particular power system. So, you know, we have all these debates in our infrastructure of, you know, it's like there's this new movie coming out soon, documentary talking about why are we still on gasoline? Why hasn't natural gas taken off? Why hasn't propane taken off? Why are these other very abundant and cheap gas sources so, you know, not used when it would be so easy to convert cars? And they're making the argument that it has to do with who owns the patents on gas pumps, and that they're legally they've effectively, the big gas companies have, they've got all these patents, they've got all these things, and then they got rules put in place on a governmental level that kind of say that this is what a gas pump should be, and it should have 86 octane, 88 and 91 or whatever, the different levels of octane, but it's all gasoline octane. And they're saying, you know, if you could actually start independent gas stations and you could get, you know, you could change some rules, you could easily have like five different types of gas, and then all of a sudden you could really expand the infrastructure. And I sit there and they have in this trailer for this video, they have like a 10-second clip with Elon Musk talking about electric cars. And I think what they're talking about is interesting, and it's, you know, it shows, and you know, it has interesting commentary on our economy and on our government and power and stuff. I think the real point is that you've got all these different forms of storing, producing mechanical energy, but they're like, you know, but if you could kind of like neutralize all that and just say we don't care where the power comes from, you know, it's just a battery, then it really opens up. I don't know. I just to me, electric cars are where it goes. That's why I'm it's actually, to be totally honest, that's the biggest reason why I say I'm going to own a Tesla one day. And not because I think Teslas are super cool, but I just think that within 50 years, everybody's going to own electric cars, and I'm hoping that Tesla is still one of the big players in the market. You know, I just think it's, if you are alive long enough, you know, and I think 50 years is long enough,
they'll
own an electric car, and they'll, you know, because it's just, you get rid of the, you know, the power delivery problem, which is cool. It's exciting. It's happening. Get used to it.
Prepare yourself.
Exactly.
All right.
So there were some big doings this week.
Announcements, really.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. It's funny that you would say that, because as I'm looking through our list of articles, pretty much nothing actually happened except in one of them. There was mostly just a lot of big announcements. The beginnings. So Apple,
we're in the middle of summer. You know, you just you're like, we're not going to actually do anything. It's summer. But we got ideas. We just got back from our retreats, so.
Yeah.
You know, there's a hint of truth to that one.
Oh yeah, it's so true. Nobody's talking about us right now. Let's announce something. The one company that actually did something is getting beat up for it because it's not good enough.
Wait, which company was that?
Amazon.
Is that on our list?
Yeah, it's all the way in Friday, man. It's Friday.
They release it. You have the actual word announce in there.
Oh, do I? That's funny. That's, you know, and you want to know why? It's because that's the title of the article. But I'm already using the service, so you know what? We'll get there. We're not going to talk about that quite yet. What we're talking about right now is the settling of a blood feud as old as time.
The Montagues and
the Capulets.
The Capulets are finally getting married at the hip.
Exactly.
The Jets, maybe.
Which is so funny because it's like, I think a lot of the perspective of the whole IBM and Apple are partnering up is what we're talking about, if you're not following. They made a big announcement that this week that that they are going to be doing an enterprise endeavor together where Apple will be handling the cloud and IBM will be handling the hardware. And it's not true. Wait, switch that. So it's basically IBM is going to be creating a suite of like 100 different enterprising apps for Apple specific hardware software suites, making them in Swift is what they're trying to say. And
really?
Probably. I'm assuming, but probably is a lot of C or Coke or Touch. I mean, Cocoa Touch involved. But yeah, so they're coming together, and they're going to be doing this. It's going to be awesome.
And again, in case you missed the pictures, there's an awesome one of Steve Jobs flipping off IBM, and like the most iconic commercial ever was Apple literally bashing on IBM.
Yeah. It's funny. Tie in here. So I'm listening to 1984 because I'm using Amazon's unlimited book thing.
Yeah.
I was just listening to the 2 minutes of hate scene, and it was like the whole time I'm like listening it, I'm thinking of that commercial with the hammer. Obviously, I think one of the things that's just funny about this is my sense has been, and this has been confirmed in a couple of the articles that I've read, is that whole like blood feud between those two companies was something that has been over for a long time. People haven't really thought about it, but what it was the whole Steve Jobs biography came out, and it just reminded everybody, you know, all the different biopics that was the big boogeyman early on. You know, they were the towering, you know.
And then Apple came out with the iPod, and well, about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Being big ain't so bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, geez, Louise. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting move. I think practically, it makes sense for both companies. Obviously, I mean that's.
You know what this reminds me of?
What?
This reminds me of when you're playing the game Monopoly, and you know, you own a couple properties in one block, and someone else owns a couple properties in one block, and you know how like no one has a monopoly, but you all kind of got properties all spread across the board, and you know, and you're kind of going, you're all kind of making money, you're all losing a little bit of money, but you're like, we're going to be here for 30 days playing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're just like, there's no end in sight for this game type of thing.
Right.
And so you get that one intrepid player who goes, I'm going to change things up a little bit. Let's negotiate a deal.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, two players, you go, I'll give you this one property if you give me those two properties, and I'll give you this other one, and the result will be we'll have two monopolies and everyone else will be hosed. Or you know what I mean? Or everyone else will still be in their frame set. And you know what I mean? And then it's like, okay, the game is now going to end. And it's still going to take 5 hours to play. Don't get me wrong. And now what you'll start to see is the next turn, some other player goes, hey, want to make a deal?
Yeah.
You know? And these deals get increasingly creative, and things start to move, and you know, and that original deal will start working out for one player really well and not so well for the other player, so they'll make another deal to try to leverage what they've got. And that's what it feels like to me, where in the enterprise space it was like, yeah, you know, we're all kind of, you know,
there were no winners at all.
Yeah, we were all moderately successful, and you had Apple, who was like, honestly, we're kicking butt over here on the game of life. Not doing so well in Monopoly. We would like to do better at that particular game. We're not necessarily losing, but we're not really getting ahead. So we're going to do something crazy.
Yeah.
And that's the sense that I got. And it's that it's like that moment in Monopoly where everyone suddenly sits up and starts counting their money and starts looking at their properties and starts looking at the other player's properties and starts scheming in their head, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the exact feeling that I have right here. We're like, we're literally watching a large game of Monopoly being played out right now.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's funny. I mean, you can tell that was a dramatic moment for a lot of people, because for example, you know, last week we were talking about the return of BlackBerry, right? They're making their new phone. They're making lots of announcements. They figured out their finances. Their stock's on the rebound. This announcement happens that day. The stock at IBM dumped 10%. I mean, it was just
at
like
BlackBerry.
BlackBerry. Well, you know, Microsoft didn't fare too well through the day either. but that's a slightly different reason.
Yeah, then we have confounding variables in that
one. Yeah. That was the insult to the injury that would come later in the week. So it was like, I mean, it was one of those things that everybody agreed the moment this announcement was made from a financial perspective that, okay, something big just happened. And what I think is interesting about it is that it's rather... it's not a very sexy deal. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, outside of the bloggers and the real techie files, it didn't get any big attention because, number one, like, you're talking about enterprise software. Like, there is very little that is more boring than enterprise software when it comes to software. And yet it's, you know, hugely important and, you know, a massive, you know, part of a lot of people's bottom lines. But it's at the same time, it's like, you know, it's not the sort of thing that normally catches front page news. And yet it was so big a deal that, this was, you know, it was definitely noteworthy.
Well, it's a combination of things, right? It's A, it's Apple. B, it is with a company that Apple started to hate. And so, you know, you just got the juicy storyline to begin with. And then I think C, people go, you know, this has the potential to actually be a big financial deal.
Yeah.
You know, which I think in one of the articles, you're cringely.
I cringely.
Yeah, where he's like, maybe not. But, you know, I don't know. Kind of crazy. I don't know. It's, I don't know what to think of it other than, again, it's like, okay, now what's, how's everyone going to react to it?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, one of the first things I did, or, you know, one of the big things that came out was, this is such a big and kind of weird shift that I think a lot of people didn't really, a lot of people don't know what to make of it. And it's, you know, so there, a lot of this like stuff is, especially like articles that you're reading are kind of shallow analysis of it. And there's huge disagreements. It's like, I cringely is like, he's saying this is not a big deal at all. You got, Motley Fools are like, this is the biggest thing that's happened in technology ever. You know, it's like, you know, you've got these huge differences of opinions about it. I did like the one, ZDNet had a article where they listed who they believe the winners and losers are going to be. Obviously, IBM and Apple are going to be the big winners in this one. It seems to be generally agreed that Apple is the biggest winner out of the two. Because they're going to be selling, you know, they're trying, it's a huge market to sell their devices to. Companies tend to have a lot of money to throw around, so it's, you know, there's some real potential there. And it just sort of, whereas IBM already has a stronghold in that market, so it's not necessarily going to move more IBM stuff. Losers, one of the interesting things is, like, you know, you talk about, part of this thing is, like you said, there was a direction the game was going. Some people were slowly building, some people were slowly losing. You know, Microsoft is still the undisputed king of enterprise, but they can't get a mobile solution together to save their lives. So there's this opening up that other companies are able to come into with tablets and phones, and Android is the budget choice for a lot of these companies, but Apple is the BY, you know, bring your own device choice for most of these companies. So there's just all this, there's all this weirdness going on, like who can win, what can happen here. And the direction that it was going was Android was slowly trying to put together a security suite to give you enterprise devices that ran Android that had the security and the ease of use that Apple offered, that would allow these companies to make the budget choice and say, look, it's good enough, let's do that. All of a sudden, you know, there's this massive differentiator between Android and iOS that wasn't there on Monday. You know, Android doesn't have a huge, you know, huge back-end enterprise solution to back them up. You know, they're doing the patch. Everything up to this point had been patchwork. There were IBM back-end things for specific companies. You know, SAP and Oracle, SAP and Oracle were moving and were doing different stuff. When I was working at Genentech, SAP was just rolling out their iOS solutions, but there were iOS apps specifically built for Genentech. Now, I'd be really surprised to see if that, you know, if that code foundation hadn't found its way into other companies. You know, once you work out the framework, then you just slap other companies' brands on it and stuff.
Logo.
But it was, yeah, exactly. But it was still, you know, it's still stuff that was, there wasn't a holistic solution. There wasn't a big, you know, army of engineers working on a new platform for a specific operating system. At these companies, and that's where Android's still stuck today. Samsung, by proxy, is going to be affected the same way, because they were the biggest of the, you know, of your Android phone sellers. So to not be able to have that market explode for Android means that Samsung's going to be hurt the most of all of your Android sellers, because they're the biggest Android sellers. You know, they're the ones that are going to, they presumably had the biggest market to, you know, edge out. Obviously, SAP and Oracle are not going to be thrilled about this either. Which I'm glad. I hate SAP. That's such a stupid software suite.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's awful. It's awful. Hmm. Their UI is just so nutty. I mean, it's like it was so clearly designed 20 years ago of a UI, and even though they keep building up the back end and getting better servers and stuff and coming up with new solutions, it's still such an like an archaic way to navigate everything. And you're just like, why can't you just make this like HTML? Why can't you make it like a website? What is so hard about that? They have struck me as a lot of enterprise companies have always struck me, which is they're so entrenched that they're about, you know, they're all about the legacy. They're all about keeping people comfortable, and they just bog down technology. And so, like, you know, I mean, come on, like, learning how to do stuff online, people do in their spare time at home. You've got classes to teach you how to, you know, enter a couple fields into SAP. Like any company that runs SAP is, it's you got to take like special training courses because it's so crazy. And it's stupid. It's so bad. So I'm glad to see them suffer.
All right.
I think the most interesting one in all of this, though, to watch how it affects them is Microsoft.
Mm. I was reading an article and I thought it was interesting. They were like, you know, in a lot of ways, Microsoft and Apple are headed in, like, they're switching places where it, you know, Apple used to be like, we do everything. We own it all. And and what you're watching is Apple slowly say, actually, IBM, we'll let you run the enterprise. We'll let you do these analytic apps. We've got our core business and competencies, and, you know, we're cool with letting you do stuff. And Microsoft is like, is pulling everything in and saying, no, we're going to make our own phones. We're going to do our own software. We're going to bring this all in-house now. We'll do everything. And so you're, you know, which is a similar thing that we've talked about, like, you know, that we've posed between Google and Apple, right? Can Google get better at hardware faster than Apple can get better at, you know, the internet, whatever it was? You know, it's a similar, it's similar to that, but I don't know, I guess it's slightly different. But it's like you're watching Microsoft isolate themselves, and you're watching Apple, you know, slowly, you know, break out. Which, I guess it makes sense, right? With Microsoft, it's like, oh, things aren't going in the direction we want. Okay, it's time to pull back, time to reassess, recollect, do things our way because we believe we can do it better. Whereas Apple's experiencing success and is growing and saying, okay, we're willing to give this part up because we're being successful in other areas and there's no reason for us to be greedy right at this moment.
Right. Yeah. And I think they're both heading towards... Apple is so far down the road of we do everything ourselves, we keep everything in-house, that them growing and expanding... You know, this is... They're both... It's like you say they're switching spots, but, and I understand why you say that, but it's like they're still so far at the two ends of the spectrum that they're just heading towards each other at currently.
That's fair.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, one of the big things.
Well, from a mobile standpoint, I think that's not entirely true.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. I'll see that. I can agree with that. One of the things that's interesting is that it's, you know, finance has been an interesting one to watch Apple deal with, because it's like, you know, somewhat legendarily, when Square first came out, and they were putting together their little piece of hardware, they, Steve Jobs and Johnny Ives met with the team at Square, and Johnny Ives basically told them how to make the Square Reader look, because as far as they were concerned, they wanted it to be successful. I mean, they knew that that was going to be huge, but they didn't mind letting this other company handle that and do that, and, you know, and leverage the two different companies. You know, that idea that, you know, I think Apple's oftentimes is gets really beat up for, you know, never wanting to let anybody else do anything, which is true, but it's what they want to do is they want to make sure the experience is right, you know. And I think in this case, what you'll find is that IBM and Apple are going to work very closely in asking the question, what is the user experience at the very end, and does it feel right? Does it feel like Apple? And which is, you know, by and large, what Apple's done in their finance, and it's what their solution for, you know, their wallet is going to be. They're not going to handle the transactions. They're not going to handle the credit card numbers. They're going to let somebody else do that, and just, but it's going to be, it's going to look and feel like Apple. You know, that's what they're doing in the business is, you know, they might be doing, it'll look and feel like Apple, and that's what they care about. Even if somebody else is building all the back end technology.
Right.
I think there's this dilemma though that I keep coming into when I look at this stuff where it's like, when it comes to Microsoft specifically, because they're still so entrenched on the larger form, the non-mobile form factors, whether it's desktops or laptops, you know, you're still going to be, IBM is critical in this because you still are going to be walking around with your iPhone, but presumably you're going to have a, you know, Windows 8 phone or, you know, computer on your desk.
Yeah.
Running your other enterprise software. So I think Microsoft is not the biggest, you know, is not a huge loser in this. I think I don't even think that this will really move the needle for them, except that it won't, it makes it harder to go down the direction that they, you know, want to go down. They want to, you know, they want the needle to move positively in mobile, and I think it's just going to stay where it is. Whereas I think companies like BlackBerry and I think even Android are going to see what progress they have made, you know, get beat up, and I think that's unfortunate for them.
Do you really think that, or are you just saying it?
That it's unfortunate for them?
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, it's unfortunate-ish.
You're a fanboy. It's okay.
Yeah. I think it's going to be really interesting. I think the one thing I will say is it'll be 2 or 3 years before we really see any huge side effects of this deal. I don't think you're going to see a mad rush for enterprise companies to, you know, big businesses to move all of a sudden all over to Apple.
No, it doesn't work that way. Are you kidding me? You won't see the first fruits of these deals for 3 months.
Well, yeah, but purchase cycles
are so long.
And I'm just not even sure that you'll really see huge, like, you won't even see, you know, these trends that we're trying to guess at what's going to happen here. You won't really be able to evaluate it for a couple of years, like what happened, who won, and how big of an effect did this deal have in it. You know, the one thing I'm not sure about is how exclusive this IBM Apple deal is. Is it one of those things where, you know, IBM mobile first for iOS? I wonder if SAP and Oracle are going to come along now and feel like they're forced to play ball with Apple too and come up with a similar suite, and all of a sudden you've got all the major enterprise back-end guys that have a non-mobile solution that was compatible with Windows and then a mobile solution that's compatible with iOS, and Android's really left out in the cold unless you're using
HP.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Which is delivering the new style of IT. So, it's got that.
Yeah, it's good. Which is nice. Good deck note for me.
So, I'm sure Microsoft hasn't had quite the opportunity yet to assess what Apple and IBM's announcement was yet. Because at least 18,000 of the workers were distracted.
Yeah.
Well, I would say all of their Nokia employees were distracted. And then the rest of Microsoft's employees were just semi-worried is maybe the best way to put it. Which I think we and everybody else called it last week when they were talking, you know, when he gave that memo about, you know, refocusing and stuff. You went, yeah, that equals layoffs. I was a little surprised that the hammer came down this soon.
Yeah. They didn't let that digest at all before they were like, cleaning house.
Yeah, you're just kind of like, I don't know. Those kind of moves are always weird for me, because it's clearly he's hitting a financial target. You know what I mean? It's one of those. Yeah. It's large round number. And will the ultimate only one be exactly that? Probably not, I guess. But what it means is they're targeting a financial number, and they did the division of wages by whatever that number was, and went, all right, 18,000, cool. What will happen?
Yeah. It's
crazy. 12,500 of which are going to be, are soon to be former Nokia employees, and then it sounds like the remaining, $5,000 will mostly be contingent workers, is kind of what I was picking up, I think. Though it sounds like it'll be a little more surgical throughout the rest of Microsoft.
Yeah, it does sound like it's a general shrinking of the population of Microsoft. But the big one is that they're basically they're firing everybody from Nokia, which is just kind of surprising. I mean, I guess
it's funny, you talked about earlier how Microsoft has this legacy business that they're not just going to get rid of, and is throwing cash at them, and it genuinely makes money. Part of that too is part of their history and their culture and their lore, and so they're not just going to burn the Windows 8 ships, and I don't blame them for not doing that.
Yeah.
But it's almost like they didn't own Nokia. They don't care about their flip phone business. It doesn't, you know what I mean? They're like, whatever, dude. Numbers.
And in all fairness, I mean, if you think about it, the reason why they bought Nokia was because the company was a disaster. I mean,
they were the number two smart dumb phone manufacturer in the world.
Yeah, but they weren't making any money. I mean,
were they not? I don't know. I understand what you're saying. There's a part of me that's like, missed opportunity, I think.
I think there is missed opportunity going on, but at the same time, it's like, I think that you know, there has got to be some truth behind the whole ELOP thing of, he got a giant bonus for the company getting bought, so he was incentivized to let the company stumble a little bit. That being said, I feel like he probably guessed that if there was a way to save the company, it was worth more money. You know, that's always the argument, right? It's like there's two incentives. It's, if things go really poorly, at least get the company bought, and that's why they give him the bonus. But, give it your old freshman try, because that's worth even more money. And I got to believe that that's his perspective. It wasn't like he wasn't out to, destroy the company so Microsoft could buy it. I think they just had a business model that was one that was going the way of the dinosaur. They're selling. They won by being the number one seller of a particular commodity that was, driven so down, so depressed in price that it just, there was no margin on it anymore. And the only way to really to make money was to continue to innovate, create better and cooler products. And everything that I had seen, and I think the market bore evidence of this, is that they did a poor job of innovating. They were suffering the BlackBerry disease. It's not like these guys are dumb, and it's not like they're these business leaders are bad. It's just the culture of the company wasn't one that was producing fruit, and all of a sudden Microsoft buys it for some reason, and you hope they're buying it because they've got this really great game plan, but to turn the ship around.
Yeah,
but I think the guy who architected the deal, that had faith in the deal, quit/ got fired almost as soon as the deal was done. New guy comes in and goes, no, I think we just bought a shipwreck. And like you said, they don't have any emotional bond to it. So
yeah.
Finland was never going to let let this happen because, well, this is our national heritage. And Ballmer wasn't going to let it happen because this was his big deal. But the fact that it needed to happen, I think, has been kind of evident for a long time. And, you know, I don't think it's fun. I feel bad for those people. I really do.
This time I believe you.
Thank you, because I do. And I really, you know, yeah, it's unfortunate. I hate to be brutal about it, but it's a company that wasn't bearing fruit. What are you supposed to do? You know, maybe you could say it was bad leadership and stuff, but fine. You weren't succeeding. And if you were there, you're working for this company and you're having, you know, and you feel like there is success and then leadership keeps leading you astray, like, get the heck out of Dodge. You know, go somewhere where your great ideas can take off. And, you know, maybe that's easier said than done, I suppose. But, you know, creative destruction of the markets, I think, is going to have some power in this. And I think long term, this was something that needed to happen because it was a company that for – I know. I guess my point
is – I agree with you. I do. I think what it means is that Android's going to take over the developing worlds, nations, which is fine, and Android will be okay with that. I think that is something where Nokia probably had some experience and expertise that could have been used, and they're just going to dump it all. And
yeah,
you know, and he hasn't been around long enough to fully evaluate it to see what they can do.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting all in on the smartphones, and because on another level, I'm like, you know, they're focusing. I like that. I can appreciate that. I'm an Apple fanboy. I get it. And so, you know, I can applaud that. I'm also just kind of like, man, you already had it all. I really don't feel like you did a full analysis of it. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you remember one time... Short-term HP CEO said, we're getting out of the computer business because we don't make any money on it. And that worked out well for him.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's good.
And let's be honest. HP's computer business is still not making money. So.
Yeah, how wrong was he?
But it's also looked at as a gateway device. You know, or it helps complete the portfolio, I guess.
Is kind of
that thought process where they're like, yeah, you're right, we don't make money on that, but we make money on the software and services that are related to it, so we're gonna keep it. You know, some.
Yeah.
And I just feel like there could have been a similar thing with the dumb phones, but maybe not.
I think they're in this weird place of, you know, the market share for Windows phones is shrinking in literally every market that they're in. It's just completely going the wrong direction for them. And, you know, on Tuesday, you got this IBM Apple deal, and I'm sure the business insiders knew that this was coming. I'm sure that wasn't a shock to Microsoft and Google. They at least knew the rumblings of it in the background, you know, that
maybe
Apple was working on an enterprise deal. And I just get the feeling that, you know, you got this giant group of people that are working for you that haven't produced a really effective piece of technology in a very long time, and you'd think you'd have these teams together of brilliant engineers, but you know how you know, it's like I do not place the blame of BlackBerry on the shoulders of squarely on the shoulders of their leadership. Their leadership could have done things to change it, but the guys underneath them weren't innovating. I mean, that's just as simple as, you know, as it
right.
was. They were allowed to, and the teams had become teams that couldn't do what they needed to do anymore. And I just get a feeling that, yeah, you're right. I do agree with you that he's so new to the position, it'd be very difficult for Nadal to really evaluate that effectively. And So this was emotionally safe for him, as opposed to being strictly logical. And there probably were a bunch of advisors that were telling, you know, that had made up their mind already, and they argued it. You know, it was more him adjudicating between different arguments, as opposed to, opposed to the one who made the decision. And so. But it's, yeah, you just look at what they're doing. They're like you said, they're getting rid of all their low-priced, low-end phones. They're getting rid of anything that was running Android. They're getting rid of, you know, it's becoming, they are going to focus on building high-end Microsoft phones, you know, iPhone competitors.
Yeah.
And
which, if Apple's any indicator, you can do pretty well in the smartphone-only market.
Yeah, except we've had this long term. You know, we talked about it just last week that, you know, how most of the time markets can only bear out two major competitors.
Yep.
Maybe you're lucky one generation, one period of time it can support multiple, but really and truly, it's just there's two platforms, and you know they're super far behind. They're going the wrong direction. I guess my question is, it's like I can't even see a path to dominance for them, because it's like you'd have to have either Microsoft, you'd either have to have Google or Apple just completely give up in order to, you know, give them space, because it's like anything that they do, any big innovation that they come up with, Google and Apple will figure out how to replicate the effect of it, if not just completely rip it off, in short order. And it's like, you know, Microsoft's biggest advantage was that they had this suite of enterprise, you know, things, back-end stuff that was already tethered into all of their code, and Apple figured out a way to replicate the ends, you know, and does that mean that Apple will become the absolute dominant player? Not necessarily, but it does mean that it's not going to give Microsoft any leverage there. It's not going to be something to propel them forward. And the only thing that they have left is the install base of XP, you know, really and truly. I mean, I guess 7 as well, but...
Yeah, you know. No, I'm with you. What it will do is it will just slowly erode Microsoft's share. It's not going to go anywhere huge. It's one of those where they just might lose like 10%. Sorry about the train. They might lose just like, you know, 10% over the next couple years, which you and me in the media, no big deal. We won't really notice it too much. Microsoft would be like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, that's billions of dollars.
Yeah, but, yeah. One percentage point when you play with their numbers are big numbers.
Dude, no doubt, man. No doubt about that. HP's the same way.
Yeah. Which is what's so funny about the fact that your computers, you know, your computer division doesn't make any money. Well, it does make money. It makes like 1 or 2%, which is a couple $1 billion. That's still a tremendous amount of money.
Well, I mean, that's the crazy part. It's like, you know, for HP's PC division, they make it's a ton. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's something crazy, like $50 billion a year in terms of revenue sales.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, it's astronomically high. But, yeah, they're like, oh, yeah, and our profit is, like, $1 billion.
Yeah.
Maybe. Which you're still like, you know, that's like 9 zeros behind the one there. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. And that's after you've already... And that's after you've already paid everybody. Let's be clear.
Right.
And so, you know, whereas in the printer division, it's a little different. The numbers aren't nearly as high, but the delta between the two is very small. And so,
yeah.
It's actually like, from a revenue standpoint, it's a fraction. From a profit standpoint, it's a multiplier.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we don't do just $1 billion. Trust me. We do more than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's interesting. How that works.
It's kind of a broader picture of these layoffs. I think that everybody is so funny because they're like, there's two ways to do layoffs, right? There's the, you know, the two bandage strategies, as it were. There's the rip it off fast,
yep,
and there's the, you know, rip it off slowly, and they both have, you know, positives and negatives. You do it fast and it's hugely disruptive, but there's less of a hit to morale. Everybody just knows, okay, today the layoffs started, today the layoffs ended. It's crazy and tumultuous during that period, but everybody settles down pretty quick because, well, you know, you got to keep your job. Doing it slowly is, it's less disruptive, but it's a huge hit to morale and productivity. And,
well, yeah, maybe. I actually kind of-ish like the way that HP's done it, because they've announced similar numbers, right? You know, we're going to let go of 25,000 people and, you know, 15,000 people. Just like, you know, they've unleashed...
HP's a dramatically bigger company, though, right? I mean, like, from a manpower, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. How many people work for Microsoft? How many people work for Microsoft? Yes, you are going to cut employees. It says here 127,000 people worldwide.
For Microsoft?
Yeah.
Yeah, but HP's got 317. I mean, it's three times the company. So by a percentage, you know, yeah, you guys are going to lay off 30,000 people, but it's still...
Well, and at least the way that HP does it is they'll say, we're not going to fire people. We're just not going to fill those positions anymore. So as people quit and or retire or whatever, you know, as people leave, we're just, that position will be gone.
Right.
Unless it's been deemed as, like, you know, uber critical, whatever-ness, then we'll let you fill it. And so there's certain organizations where they're like, no, this one's done. You know, or certain businesses where they're just like, nah, we're not investing in this one anymore. As people leave, it's done. And then it does hit a certain tipping point where they're like, all right, guys, you got to find new jobs somewhere. And, you know, and they'll, and then what'll happen is as people quit in other, you know, or leave again in other parts of the company, they'll get filled with people from that original, from that dying group. Does that make sense? And so in a sense, sure, it's a large layoff number when they say 25,000 people, but in another sense, no one's having the tough conversation.
Yeah, which is nice.
Yeah, and it's, sure, it's more work to do it, but I think the result is better. I mean, like, the team that I'm on right now, we've got a guy who we're working with where his group is being shut down, and he's literally doing, like, a tryout for our team.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're like, yeah, maybe he's a fit, maybe he's not, we don't know. You know, and so, you know, and so it's stuff like that, that's happening. You know,
But I think the direction I was going was that thought of, I agree, I like the way that goes, but it takes a lot more time and it requires a lot of...
It's a multi-year process.
Yeah, whereas, you know, Microsoft wants to get this done in a couple of months. And so, like, you know, as I was saying, like, there's these two different strategies, like the long way to do it that's less disruptive or the quick way that's more disruptive but that hurts morale less. And the problem, as you said already, is that HP or that Nokia is easy. You do, because there's, you know, you're going to get rid of so much of the company that you don't mind the massive disruption because you're majorly changing what that division of Microsoft is about. You're fundamentally changing it, so you don't, you know, you're going to disrupt it anyways. Whereas the rest of their cuts, the other 5,000 people they're going to fire, are going to be, even though it's a relatively small number, especially in comparison to the entire company, but it's one of those things where those ones are going to be surgical and long term. So it's like you get the major disruption, morale, you know, knockdown of firing 12,000 people, 13,000 people on Thursday. And then, you know, and then you've got the long range, just, oh my gosh, I'm going to keep my job for the next 6 months, which they say boosts productivity, but really hurts morale, and long term it's bad.
Well, again, I think, and they'll communicate it similar like HP did for those 5,000, where they'll be like, don't worry about it. You're not, we're going to let this happen organically. Oh, you know, because they'll do that in a year. That's easy to do. Because you just go, hiring freeze, done.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just wait until you're 5,000 light. And then you say, okay, now we can, you know, open them back up again, which is how HP did it. And which is annoying if you're trying to move around in the company. Don't get me wrong, because you're not going anywhere. So, you know, so there's that. You know, and with the Nokia guys, they're just like, dude, they don't even have Microsoft badges. They're not in the company. It's so easy. And they're like, they're not going to come work in Redmond. So,
yeah.
See ya!
Yeah.
You know, that was just, that's the classic, it's not personal, it's business move. But you're like, man, kind of a jerk move, but I get it too.
Oh, yeah. I it's interesting. It's interesting seeing them have to make that decision.
Well, it's just, normally you see that from a company, you know, like BlackBerry, where they're struggling financially, and they're like, we need to do something now to change this up. Again, it's an internal monopoly game. We need to really just, like, get after this, because we're going to lose otherwise. And so, whereas, like with HP, it was still making money every year. You know, it wasn't in a financial crisis. And so it was kind of like, no, we can take our time and do this a little more smartly instead of just taking a blunt object to it.
But yeah.
Anyways, that's way too much talk about an announcement. let's talk about robots.
Oh, man. So, Apple's making a new phone, and
really,
depending on what blogs you listen to, they've either started or they haven't started, or they've started with the 4.7 inch model, but they're
is
never
it too early to talk about naming
model.
Conventions? What you think they'll actually name it? Is it too early to do that?
I think it's too early.
Okay, do you think they'll just go with the iPhone 6?
It's too early, but we're gonna do it anyways. I think so. I don't know. I think they're gonna do like what they did with the 5C and the 5S. They're gonna come up with, it's gonna be the iPhone 6 something. The iPhone 6 something. The iPhone 6 something. You know, they'll have the 5. You know, the 6C will be the 5S. And you know, the more I think about it, the more I think that they're not gonna do a major chip upgrade. I gotta believe that they're gonna do it. You know, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Anyways,
but it's,
we'll get there.
But they're moving on to moving into full on production of these things. But the inevitable is occurring. And I've been predicting this since, geez, I was probably 15 years old, that the only thing cheaper than slave labor is free labor. And it's coming, and you know, it's even in China, you know, robotics, the capital expense on robots is huge, right?
Right.
But the operating expense is turning on a light switch. Whereas with human beings, the capital expense is virtually non-existent. You just have to teach them how to, you know, do something. You know, you're not buying them, generally. And
generally.
But the operating expense is kind of fixed. It's what you pay, and it goes up over time. And so Apple and more importantly Foxconn, their big old partner in Honhai, have developed. They've slowly been automating all these process lines over time. Generally, the automation has been in things that really require, that are too high skilled for even high skilled people to be able to do. Like for example, one of the big innovations they had was in the last I think it was the 5. When they cut the glass and they cut the steel rim for the two different phones, everything comes within a certain margin of
tolerance.
It has a certain tolerance, correct? And so generally when you're designing stuff, what you say is, you make the tolerances such that the biggest screen, the biggest piece of glass, will fit in the smallest hole, which means sometimes if you put the smallest piece of glass in the biggest hole, there'll be a bigger gap. That drove Johnny Ives crazy because it didn't look right. So what they did was they basically had this process go, okay, we've got our tolerances that we're willing to accept, but we're going to have a robot measure everything and keep track of what the actual measurements are. And so we know each piece of glass, we've got them all. Each one has its own identification, its own number, and each piece of metal has its own number. And we're going to take the two and we're going to put them together when they fit. And that's something that just people can't do. It's not, you know, that's not practical. So you have a robot do that. And as you get more and more into it, it's getting to the point where they're just, you know, they're taking more and more people out of it. So this assembly line in Hanai is going to get 10,000 robots. There's still like 100,000 employees working at this place, throughout its various factories in China. Foxconn employs more than 1.2 million workers. They've reportedly hired an additional 100,000 workers in China. So it's one of those things where the numbers are still huge. I mean, they're employing unbelievable scales of people. But the thing is that, you know, one robot can do the work of a lot of different people because it never quits. It never gets tired. It never goes to the bathroom. It never needs to be paid. It just does its job again and again and again. And, you know, we're getting better at making robots. We're getting better at programming robots. We're getting better at making them forward compatible. And the trick is, it's, you know, part of it is you make a robot that can do many different things, and then what you do is you also design what you're building to be built on that equipment. And so, you know, this is the direction they're going. And it's just one of those things where how many people would they have had to hire if they weren't going to have it all be done by robots? I have no idea. But that's the direction they're going. They're trying to fire all their people, despite the insane cheapness of labor in China. It's still cheaper to build robots.
I don't know about fire all their people, but
yeah. Well, the thing is that you still need an army of engineers and technicians to operate everything.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's, you know, an army of engineers and technicians is going to be a tiny fraction.
Well, and I'm thinking about like that 1.2 million workers, and they added an additional 100,000. Percentage wise, if we like put this in Microsoft terms, that would be like 10,000 people.
Yeah.
It's like, that's, I don't know, that's a whole lot of robots.
Yeah, it's true, and it's a process. I mean, it's a, you know, part of it is, and one of the things that's unfair here is Foxconn is the biggest electronics assembler in the world, and they don't build iPhones only. They're the primary builder of iPhones, and that's usually what they, you know, when you read about them, it's usually in relation to Apple. But they also build Xboxes and TVs and DVD players and Blu-ray players and electric shavers, and I mean, they build everything. You know, they are the biggest electronics assembler in the world.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it'd be interesting to see, of that 100,000 people that they just hired, what projects are they working on? You know, is it one of those things where all the automation is going into Apple lines first, and then, or, you know, and is it at Apple's direction, or is it something that Foxconn wants to see happen across all their different markets? But I guess my bigger thought is here is just, it's the trend, it's where it's going, you know. And this is the irony of wanting to bring manufacturing back to America. It's you know, and this is made evident with the with, you know, the Made in America, Made in USA on the Mac Pros, that they're largely made by machines. You know, it's like, people are involved, yes, but the number of people that are required to build them are so small compared to what it used to be that it's, you know, it's cool it's made in America, but most of the great jobs are the guys that are designing the robots that build all these computers. And I think that's what you're going to see, you know, and this trend in the future. And it's just, it'll be fascinating to see what it does to China.
Yeah.
As, you know, because so much of their growth has been about around the fact that they hire, you know, 1.2 million people to do manufacturing jobs, you know. And
yeah, it's interesting too, where it's like, in the U.S. it took a really long time for manufacturing to kind of disappear and or be replaced by robots. Yeah. It's happening faster in China. They're not going to quite get the same growth boom that the U.S. had.
Yeah.
Just because things happen faster.
They are going to get fat soon, though. That's exciting as everybody becomes, you know, as they all become service industry jobs just like us. So they, you got that to look forward to.
You're welcome, China.
Go to McDonald's. It tastes great.
But maybe you're not inside. Maybe you want to go do something like baseball. Go play a game.
So I like, you know, obviously we talk about some particular companies and pieces of technology more than anything else, but you know, we like the outside technologies too, and there's a new one that the Nike is coming up with. They're more than just your cool kicks. Nike's building a baseball glove. So do you have a baseball glove, James?
I do. I have two.
Where do you keep them?
In my sports box of stuff.
Nice. I have a baseball glove that our dad bought for me, and I don't know when, because it fits my adult hand. I mean, like, it's an adult baseball glove, but I never played baseball as an adult. But I've literally have no recollection of when I got this baseball glove, but I keep it in my trunk just in case anybody ever wants to play catch. I'm ready to go. You want to know how many times?
Three.
People, none. Literally none. I get it out and play catch with myself, but nobody ever wants to play catch. And you want to know why? It's because we're all fat and we all sit and do.
Or it's not everyone carries their baseball glove around in their trunk.
Yeah,
I played catch in the last month.
What? So, who did you play catch with?
Some people from church.
Oh, that's cool.
We were out at a lake having fun. I brought my gloves. The trick is to have two gloves in your trunk.
How much does a baseball glove cost? Oh, well, I know that I'm... You know what? Speaking of... so the whole reason I brought this up, Nike's coming up with a new baseball glove. And, you know, traditionally, like, obviously... The baseball glove is traditionally leather, and you get it, and then you have to spend like months oiling it and forming it to a baseball.
Yeah, that's part of the fun.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, that's the tradition, the smell, the feel, and everything.
Yeah.
Nike is destroying the magic of a baseball glove.
It's destroying America, is what you just told me.
Yeah, pretty much. It's funny. It's funny. That's kind of what my reaction to this whole thing was. I really like the idea of this, but basically they're coming up with this new baseball glove, and they're taking cues from its footwear advances. The outfit leveraged its Hyperfuse and flexible flywire technology to cut out extra heft and add versatility. They said leather is still the best option for the palm, but they do like laser perforating to it now so that it is it's more flexible already. And basically what we've taken the traditional leather of the palm and perforated it to remove some of the structures so it forms more quickly. Therefore the glove is ready to use straight out of the box. They use it at the MLB All-Star game this year. They're Gonzalez. I don't know who he plays for. It doesn't matter. But they'd actually got some play on national TV, and it looks like the webbing between the thumb and the pointer finger is like plasticky too. And I'm sure it's some sort of soft rubber. But yeah, it's cool. It's actually, I think it's really cool. Carlos Gonzalez, and he's the Colorado Rockies. There we go. It's called the Vapor 360 Fielding Glove. I'm sure it's crazy expensive.
Yeah. This thing's got to be where. Let's see here. I feel like they would have given a price on this article had it actually had a price.
Yeah. Let's see. Fielding.
I mean, this thing's got to be a couple hundred bucks, right?
Oh, I'm sure. You can't even buy it. Come on now. Nike.com. There we go. Nike. No, that's. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's right. Yeah. It's literally not even a price.
All right.
So it's expensive is what we're getting at. But
this feels like a solution to a non-existent problem.
A solution looking for a problem?
Yeah, which in reality, like you said, is actually taking away some of the fun. Which I guess is what people say about some of the autonomous vehicles. Like, dude, driving is the fun part. Why would you?
Yeah. That's
like,
kind of mine.
No, this is different.
Yeah. I do. I guess that's actually why I bring this up, is because it's like, you know, it's part of the magic of baseball and that whole culture of it is, you know, getting a glove and forming it and everything. And
the smell of the oil and wrapping it in saran wrap and sleeping underneath it. I don't know. That's fun. And you don't do it all the time, right? You do it for a little bit. And that makes it your glove. And I don't know.
Yeah. I gotta get a second glove, though. You're absolutely right. You know what I should do? I should get, like, one of those, like, cheap 12-year-old plastic ones. And have my nice leather one.
Just go to Big Five, pick up one of those $35, $45 gloves, and then you can have the pleasure of forming it and making it work. And
yeah, forming it to my hand. Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Nike.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. Definitely, that's the word. It's interesante. But...
I'm gonna let you keep going. One more, and then I'll go.
Okay, cool. So this is another cool one. This is just a fascinating thing. You know, talking about who's winning and losing in the mobile market. The iPhone 5S has outsold the Galaxy S5 in the first full month of the Galaxy being on sale. So
that's obviously bad, but why?
By and large, I think it's not necessarily the amazingness of the iPhone so much as it's the utter dud of a phone that the S5 was. I think there was absolutely nothing compelling. There was no reason for people to go out and buy it. They didn't do a good job selling it.
That was the one with their own, like, Touch ID that didn't really work, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and it sold terribly. So it's, you know, that thing of the upper end of the iPhone, you know, as Samsung and Google continue to take more and more of the overall market, that highly profitable high-end market is something that, you know, Apple is more and more firmly in control of. And, you know, and it's becoming the high-end Android phone is becoming more and more of a niche inside of a niche. You know, I want a high-end phone, but I want it to be Android. Is not something that many people are doing. Generally.
Yeah, this is the classic when you look at the PC market and you look at PCs like above $1,000. You know, Apple actually has like 70% market share there. And then when you go below $1,000, they have like 0%.
Yeah.
And that's why they're sitting at 10. overall,
right.
And you get the sense that the exact same thing's happening in the smartphone market, where you get above I don't know what the magic number is, $500,
probably.
You know, they're significant, and then when you go under 500, they're like, yeah, we have like nothing.
And I think even more to the point of it's anything above $100, after the what's that word where they do the thing?
Subsidy.
After the, you know, $100 after the subsidy and you buy an iPhone, $100, you know, under $100 after the subsidy and you buy Android. And, you know, that's clearly where it's going. And, you know, Apple's still making a crazy enough profit where they're taking the majority of the profit for the entire industry.
That's going to be tough for Samsung.
Yeah.
Because you're going to sell a ton of phones and not make the money you're used to making. That's that's tough.
And they're, you know, and it used to be that they were double dipping, where, you know, they were selling phones, making money on phones, but they were also basically building all the individual components for Apple. So they were making money off of the iPhone. And as a whole company, even though they're very different divisions. And now that, you know, TSMC is doing all of the chip stuff and they're not buying, you know, screens or anything, more and more and more of the manufacturing is leaving, or component supply is leaving Samsung. And they went from double dipping and making tons and tons of money to no dipping, and, you know, they've run out of guacamole, and it's a bummer.
But, and the nice part about all of us is that if you're not growing, you're pretty much dead in our book.
Yeah, exactly. Why would you even be around as a company?
Yeah, you might as well just close the doors if you're not going to grow anymore. I mean, come on. Who cares if you're still making money and just shrinking down to the size that you should be?
Or, yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Very interesting. I just,
Okay. All right. Let's switch subjects. Let's talk about insurance.
Okay.
Do you have insurance?
I don't know. What kind of insurance?
I don't know. Let's start with car insurance.
I do have car insurance.
Do you have... who's that with? Just out of curiosity.
Nationwide is on your side.
Really? Yeah. Going with the mom team.
Yeah. Didn't even get an employee discount. they were just the cheapest.
Really? All right. So is that... do you actually have like an agent that you're working with?
No. Or... I guess technically, but I've only talked to him like once, and he called me when I first signed up online and said, kind of went over all the numbers and everything. He said, yeah, I'm the guy on your account. I was like, cool. And then that was like 2 years ago. So I probably had three different agents since then, and I've never talked to any of them. So.
Yeah, no, I understand. We have a specific agent that we work with, and because part of it was we wanted to develop that relationship with them, and so we have.
Who are you with?
State Farm, but that's kind of a secondary issue. It was the person that we cared about. Mm. And he's a guy where it's like we will go out to dinner, hang out with him type thing, you know?
Oh, nice.
That kind of relationship, because that was important to us. But there's all sorts of insurance out there. Car insurance is just one example. Another one is life insurance.
Yes.
If and you die, you could be insured. If I were you, I wouldn't have it, because...
Well, it's a good thing that I am me, and I agree, because I don't have it.
Now, if you were married, and especially if you had kids, I would say that's different.
Yeah. Thanks for rubbing it in.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Now, how about long-term disability? You got that one?
I don't.
What about even through your employer?
That's why I say I don't know. I might have it through my employer. Okay. I've never asked.
What about volcano insurance? You got that one?
I do not have volcano insurance. I'm quite confident.
Volcano insurance. All right. So one of the things that you have not experienced yet, because...
Volcanoes? Yes.
Well, that's true. But one of the things you have also not experienced yet is the joys of a pushy insurance agent. Because, you know, they're paid a commission for how much insurance you have. And so they have an incentive for you to have a lot of insurance.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
The problem with that is that they are able to... they're good at what they do. And so a lot of people feel taken. One of the biggest ones is something called whole life insurance. It's essentially you buy it and you have it for your life. And there's this idea in there that it also works as a savings account, and so you get a return, but then you also pay fees on it. the bottom line is that you get it for your entire life, and the whole idea is, like, if you get it when you're really young, it's cheap, and that rate's kind of locked in for the rest of your life as long as you make payments.
Yeah.
There's another option out there called term life insurance that is, as it sounds, it's for a specific period of time, a term.
And sort of like what your, like, car insurance would be, more along that lines, right? Or is it just a completely different
paradigm? No, it's a little different. It's like saying, if I die in the next 20 years, I'll be covered.
Okay.
And so you'll pay into it for 20 years, and then you're done. You know, if you die, 20 years and a day later, your family gets nothing. It's kind of the idea.
You get nothing.
Nothing. Whereas if you had a whole life, you know, even if it were 40 years down the line, you would still get it. The issue that whole life is significantly more expensive than term. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's something in the neighborhood of, like, if whole life was $100, term would be like $8. You know, we're literally talking like less than 10% of the cost. And all the financial gurus will tell you, pretend like you were paying into whole and just put that into your 401k.
Yeah.
And depending on your age, like for you, you're pretty young, you would do like a 30-year deal. And they're like, that way at the end of your 30 years, you would just pull the money from your 401k, because that would be then tax-free, because you'd hit 55 and you're good to go. And they're like, and your return would be so much massively better. They're like, in almost every single case, they're like, you should go for term instead of whole life. The problem, though, is your insurance agent has a 10% of the commission size. And so they have a big incentive to get you into whole life. And if you ever have an actual agent, he will try to talk you into whole life insurance, period.
Huh. Yeah.
And this bugs people because they clearly do not have your best interest in mind for this.
Right.
I'll even go as far as to say the guy who I would consider to be friends, who I know well, did it to me. And I was like, dude, you do know I know how to do math, right? I mean, he goes, well, I have it and it cost me this much. I'm like, that's great. It's math. This does not make sense to do this. Why would you ever recommend it to me? And then I go, you just want it for the commission, and then you have that awkward silence, whatever. Okay, that was a very long setup.
Yeah, it's interesting to learn about insurance, but I do.
This is an example, yeah. This is an example of one of those real-life services that just has a friction of information and something that technology can help with. And that is where Policy Genius comes into play. It is an education-driven platform for buying insurance. So right now they're based in Brooklyn, and what they start off with is what they call an insurance checkup. This is a tool that will give you personalized advice and quotes from over 30 different insurance sellers. And, it asks you a bunch of questions and then says, okay, based on what you told us, here's what we think you actually need based on algorithms and not sales quotas. And then here's who will actually give them. Because, you know, one of the other ones that I'm always like, I don't know. They're like, what do you want your limits to be? Like, how much do you think your life is worth?
Like, wow. Yeah, I have no idea.
They play games where they're like, well, how happy do you want your kids to be? And do you want your wife to have to continue working when you pass away? If you pass away? Before you know it, they're like, you need a $100 million policy, don't you? You know, or something crazy like that. Whereas... Yeah. Their promise to people is, we will give suggestions that make sense, and they're like, and we don't care about the commission size, because we're looking out for you. And what's cool about it is because they're able to turn it into a technology-driven solution, you can go online, you don't have to talk to anybody. and then, you know, and then you can do the comparison shopping. It's like, which one is that? Is that LendingTree? Is that the one where if you're looking for a loan, they'll, you know, they'll show you a bunch of bank loans?
Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
I think so.
And then you just pick the one that you're like, I like this rate. Similar deal. Similar deal to that. I'll be honest, there's a part of me that's like, I feel like having an individual agent may have been, it's not quite worth what it used to be. Other than, to be fair, you know, when looking at other properties, it's nice to have someone I can call on the phone and say, hey, just real quick, what's a quote for this? And not have to go through the ringer. That's kind of nice.
That is nice.
But yeah, anyways, I saw this. Policy Genius is the name of it. And it's kind of a cool little setup that's helped. Their goal is to get rid of one of those pain points that people have in life that you'll have eventually one day. You'll be like, I know exactly what James is talking about. This
unless
is
I don't get married. Dang.
You'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe this current day was the one. You never know.
Yeah, don't jinx it. What was I going to say? I'm distracted now. So finally, we're going to get back around to this. I guess this is the last story for the night.
Yeah, I think so, too.
So Amazon, officially, they did something this week. Unlike everybody else, they didn't just announce things. They actually did something. They launched, after announcing, Kindle Unlimited, which is their version of Netflix their version of Amazon Instant. What's their video service called?
Instant Watch.
Yeah, Instant Watch for books. Or Netflix for books is what everybody's calling it.
Yeah.
Basically, you sign up. It costs $10 a month. You can have as many books on your device as you want from their list, or you can do as many audiobooks as you want from their list.
Nice.
It actually really is nice. And the library that they have options to is a little bit bigger than their library that is for, what's it called? Their checkout, their light. Because if you have Prime for $100 a month or whatever, or a year, it's got like 400,000 books that you can check out one at a time. This one is you can do as many as you want, which for me is better because I tend to read multiple books at the same time. And it's got a bigger library, and it's got the audiobooks, which is very cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
And as I mentioned earlier, I'm trying it out. I figure, you know, for the podcast, it's 30 days free at the very least. So right now I'm listening to 1984.
Yeah.
And so I got that on my phone, which is, you know what I really like? Oh, the other thing is that their like checkout library only works on Amazon devices. So your Kindle Fire, Kindle, stuff like that. So for someone with a Paperwhite like me, that's okay. But what's cool about this is that this rental service works on my iPhone too. And the reason that's important is because I can do the audiobooks on my iPhone, and I can do the real books on my the digital books on my Paperwhite, which is very nice. The real only problem of it is that the library is not gigantically huge. It doesn't have all the books in the world.
Is that because authors have to opt into it, or
it's actually the big publishing houses are? Yes, there are a lot of authors do have to opt into it, and they're working out the system on how they're going to do that.
Mm.
But the big thing is that it's the big five publishing houses are very reticent to jump into this, because
makes sense.
You know, for the same reason that major studios are reticent to jump into the whole Netflix deal. But I think Amazon is going to try to basically do what Netflix does and do, you know, become their, this is their between Create Space and this is them becoming a publisher. And, you know, and if you get a couple of really good books and it's, you know, if you can get a system seller, if you can get a good book that this is the only venue it's published on, you know, that can be pretty huge for Amazon. But
that makes sense. So this is really only worth it if you read a lot, huh?
Yeah, that's kind of what the determination was. If you're a big reader and you're spending, You know, if you read more than one book a month and you don't really care what you read, or you don't care if they're classics and stuff, you know, then that it's worth it. I probably will, I'll definitely give it a try for this month. I might have it for a month or two. I'm not sure I'm going to have it long term until they really expand the library. But the mechanics of it, it works great. You just go on Amazon, you check out all the different books. They've got different ways to sort it, so you can see where there's audiobooks, you can see where there's real books, or just regular old letter books, and all the different genres and stuff. So it's I really like the service in principle. And as they expand, which they will. I mean, it's not like, you know, they're going to continue to work with the big publishers, and as you get more and more books.
Totally.
And actually, one of the big things is they got the big series. You know, they got a couple of series that were super important. They paid top dollar to get the Harry Potter's and the
Twilight, Hunger Games,
in there. Those are the two big ones that I remember. Which is nice. It's like I've never bought any of the Harry Potter's.
Really?
And yeah, I've read them all. But
I got the British audiobooks. Awesome.
Nice. I always borrowed them from sisters and girlfriends to read them all, and which was pretty effective. It's kind of cool. Now I've actually thought that it would be nice to reread them, but I've never wanted to buy them again. Mm. And as we've already covered, since I'm alone in my life right now, I don't have any girlfriends to borrow them from.
Still have a sister.
That's true. That's true. But this will be nice, just because it'll be able to jump it on the Kindle, and
yeah,
you know, I really like the idea, though, of, you know, this idea that you know as a holistic solution to, you know, no longer buying books. It's, you know, and I think, yeah,
well, it's part of that, like, that asset light shift.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the cool things, one of the interesting things, that I subscribe to a bunch of different blogs and subreddits and stuff about writing. So how they actually do the, you know, with you know, one of the big questions is, how do authors get paid? Because, you know, yeah, if I download 1984 and then never read it, is George Orwell going to get any money? No, because he's dead. But if I, you know. But, you know, practically, for the people who do, you know, who do finance, you know, at what point do you get paid? Is it when they download the book? Is it when they finish the book? And the answer is, it's when they've read 20% of the book.
Really?
Is when you get your cut, yeah. And that shifts depending, and I'm sure it'll shift over time, but that's their initial, you know, starting point, so... It's sort of like YouTube, you know. When do you get your view? As you're counting up your views, how much of a YouTube video do you have to watch in order for them to view? Do you just have to start the video? Do you have to finish the video? I don't actually know the answer to that question.
It's magic algorithm.
Exactly. It's fuzzy math.
Yep. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. I'm glad you like the service. I'm obviously be interested to hear if you keep going with it or not, or if you're like, it was okay.
Yeah. I definitely like having the audiobooks. The audiobooks are nice.
Audiobooks are fantastic.
Yeah. And I like that this is a very, very, very affordable way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, the service is expensive, but I guarantee you it's because of the audiobooks. Yeah, it's the biggest audiobook library of this sort anywhere. Everybody else is, you can rent books. This is, you know, the real selling point here, I think, is going to be the audiobooks, and that might be what keeps me around, especially for those classics that can be very boring to read, but are, you know, great to actually like to hear and have somebody just speaking at you.
Yeah.
I've
said that for a while, right? I listen to a bunch of biographies, and I used to struggle to get through them, and once I discovered kind of the audiobook thing, I was like, oh man, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I can do biographies all day long now.
Yeah, because they're relentless. They just keep talking.
I know. Well, and I actually can focus and pay attention to it. I just, you know, but...
Yeah, exactly.
It's good. Though, recently I've been getting more into actual, like, reading. Right now I'm reading what is it? It's Dave Ramsey, Total Money Makeover book. And because I'm just, I've never read it.
Yeah.
And it's not really an audiobook type of book. But I've,
yeah.
I just added a book to my list now. It's only available in paperback. And I was just like, really? Come on. That's annoying.
Yeah.
I have to get the physical book. Ugh.
This is awful.
I know. Yeah. Anyways, cool, man. Cool. Good show.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if I'll put it in our top 10, but, you know, it's not bad.
Wow.
I know.
Ringing endorsements. At least we waited until people have gotten all the way through the podcast to disappoint them.
Yeah. Yes. Well.
title of the podcast, one of our top 10 podcasts.
Sorry. Well, you know, and I had to wait until I got to the end to make that decision. But
yeah.
Which I would say it's not our fault. It's a bunch of announcements.
No, it's true. Yeah. It was a slow week.
Let's pass that buck on. Oh, man. Well, anyways. Let's see here. Switch up the audio and all that fun stuff. Yeah, man, we will talk next week, and we'll do our show on Saturday, though, because I'm going to be busy Sunday, but it'll still be good. So, everybody else, thank you for joining us. My name is James Furlow. My brother is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time.